I'm going to stop spotlight my video. Now, in order to do this right, you need to go back to gallery view, but that way it'll you keep everybody's picture in the screen, but my video will be the only one to appear in the recording, which is
how, I love looking at you.
You know what? It's I'm sorry, but you're welcome to do it however way you wish. It's fun. Then we're going to share a screen and we're going to go to full screen, and actually let's go out of full screen and let's go to speaker view, and here we go. Okay, I got all my steps that I usually take are all done and we're ready to go.
Except the mute.
Thank you very much. That would eventually happen, no doubt. Okay. Feel free to unmute as you wish. Good. We're ready to go. Can everybody see the screen? Is it big enough? I can make it bigger, but it would be a little harder to navigate. Okay. Perek Yudalet is where we're up to. The last thing we saw was Avshalom in exile in Eretz Geshur by his grandfather, and having killed Amnon, or having orchestrated the murder of Amnon, and for what he had done to Tamar. So we have that whole episode is now behind us. And Avshalom runs to Geshur. David has, actually, let's jump back to the previous parak, just the last pasuk. Batachal David Hamelach Latzet El Avshalom. David's soul yearned, longed for Avshalom. Kinicham al Amnon Kimet, having been comforted for Amnon. Amnon had died, Amnon was dead, Amnon was not coming back. He understood that there's a certain psychological process that a person goes through in the process of mourning, when that recognizes that at some point you move forward in life. But for David, Avshalom is a much more critical issue right now, because Avshalom is certainly alive and Avshalom is in exile and he's pining to see Avshalom. So that's more or less where the parak leaves us, and it leaves us with this tension between what David feels and what is actually happening. Because on the one hand, he's hoping for, yearning for, or pining for Avshalom. On the other hand, Avshalom is an exile for a reason. If David would you just invite Avshalom back into to Yerushalayim, all kinds of things would happen. Avshalom is guilty of fratricide. Avshalom is guilty of killing the crown prince of the state. It's an act of treason. David can't just wave a magic wand and invite Avshalom back as much as he wants to. And so that really gives us the opening to Perek Yudalet. Vayeda Yoav ben Tsruya ki lev hamelech al Avshalom. Suddenly Yoav is back in the picture. Anybody remember Yoav? Been out of the conversation for a little bit. Who is Yoav? Who is Yoav ben Tsruya?
David's nephew.
He is David's nephew. He is David's general. He is the general of the army that was sitting out the camp of Ammon when David was in Yerushalayim with the story of Bathsheba, which we went through 2 years ago. Yoav has been David's right-hand man, his chief of staff and general of his army from the very beginning. Yoav has had two brothers. One was killed in battle. Yoav and his brothers are... how do we put it? They are the buvans, right? They're the tough ones of the malchus. More than once, David has to pull the reins back tight to hold Yoav in place. We'll see that a little bit later as well. Just to give us some perspective. Let's jump to I'm just trying to get. Here's a chapter later or two chapters later. David is running from Yerushalayim, and there's a man there by the name of Shimei ben Gera who we'll learn all about. We'll discuss, and he begins to curse David and begins to throw stones at David, and as David is running with his tail between his legs, running from Yerushalayim, and Vayomer Avishai ben Tsruya is Yoav's brother. There were three brothers. One was killed in battle, Masa, and the other two, Avishai and Yoav. Avishai says to David, Lama yekalel akelev amet azeh adoni, Adoni HaMelech. Why should this dead dog curse the king? I'll go take care of it. Vasivet Rosho, I'll go and cut his head off. And David's response is, Ma li v'lachem b'nei Tsruya? What am I going to do with you, sons of Tsruya? Right? It's not just Avishai, it's Avishai and Yoav, b'nei Tsruya. And he has them in very powerful positions, but at the same time, he has lots of trouble from these two very tough generals that are part of his inner circle. But he holds them at close range. If you were paying close attention to the Haftorah this past Shabbos, you would have heard David's final message to his son Shlomo on his deathbed. One of the final things he tells him to do is finally deal with Yoav for all of the treasonous activity that Yoav has committed. Yoav is a character we'll come back to many times. But for now, Vayeda Yoav ben Tsruya ki lev hamelech al Avshalom. Yoav understood that the king was, his heart was towards Avshalom, was pining for Avshalom. And so he begins a process to orchestrate the ability for David to bring Avshalom home. Veishlach Yoav tekoa, veikach misham isha chachama, vayomer elea. He sent a message to Tekoa. Tekoa is more or less what Tekoa is today, an area of someone in the larger area of the Hare Yehuda, and that's sort of where Yoav is from, area of Beit Lechem and Ephrat. Veishlach Yoav Tekoa veikach misham isha chachama. And he engages the services of a very wise woman. Now, why she is described as chachama is something we're going to have to explore. What is her wisdom? In what way does she demonstrate this unique accolade? But for now, we'll take it at face value. He finds somebody who's will follow his instructions, but also have enough seichel to and enough wisdom to navigate a very significant task. But Yomar Eleh, he says to her the following: Hit ablina. Step one. Demonstrate, pretend you're in mourning. Hitablina velivshina bigde eva. Go wear garments of mourning. Ve'alta suchi shemen. Don't put on any oils or perfumes or moisturizing creams. Ve'ayit ki isha ze yamim rabim mitabelet amet. And pretend that you are mourning for a long time. With one of the certain aspects of avelus, of mourning, you can see here reflected the notion of not anointing yourself with oil. And pretend that you've been mourning for a long time. This is part of the ruse that you are going to present. Uvat el hamelech, bedibart elav kadavar hazeh. Come to the king and speak these words. I'm going to give you a story. Vayasem Yoav et advarim befia. And so Yoav put words in her mouth. Yoav told her this story. This is what you're going to say. Now, keep in mind this phrase, because we're going to come back to the question of how much of what she says is coming from Yoav versus how much is coming from herself. All right, so that's a challenging question we have to navigate through in this parak. That's where we'll see a little bit of her chokhmah. But for now, at least the framework of this is set in place by Yoav. Uvat el hamelech v'dibet ha'elav kadvaza v'yasim yoav v'tadvim b'fia. V'tomen ha'isha ha'tku'it el hamelech. So she comes to the king and she tells him a story. She falls on her face, and she falls on the ground, and she prostrates herself before the king. She says, Hoshia HaMelech, O king, save me. So right away, you understand that the context of her request isn't just a story. Her context of her request is very personal. Hoshia HaMelech, she starts, before she's even told him what the dilemma is, she's put before him the possibility that whatever her dilemma is, he can help, he can respond, he can. Let me teach you all a computer trick. If you want to unmute quickly without having to go through all the control A and the moving the mouse, etc., you just have to hold the space bar. It acts like a little microphone button. Remember those old microphone buttons where you held it in and you can speak, right? If you press the space bar, you've got an open mic. If you let go of the space bar, you have a closed mic. It's a very simple trick. So
can I ask a quick question?
Sure can.
Did she just walk in and see David? Did she not need an appointment? Was that just open field for people to come in and talk with David?
I'm sure it wasn't open field. I'm sure it had a process. The process being somewhat irrelevant at this point, because the issue is the conversation. Given the fact that this is all orchestrated by Yoav, I don't think it would have been hard for her to get that appointment. But at the end of the day, people approached the king. That was not uncommon.
I thought he was kind of hiding.
Yes and no. He's hiding in the sense, back in Perek Yudbet, we called it hiding when he wasn't on the battlefield, so he was in his palace, but he is still functioning as the king.
He just didn't say anything to his kids when they did that.
Well, that was part of the issue, right? But we talked about the fact that that Tamar still has to get permission from David to go to Amnon. Amnon has to make the request from David, right? There's still a conversation. He's still certainly part of the conversation. Okay. Malach, what can I do for you? Batomer, she tells him the following story. Aval isha almana ani, vayamot ishi. Now, the translation here is a little bit of a giveaway. So let's stop for a second and just understand this phrase. Aval isha almana ani, vayamot ishi. Isha almana ani, I am a widow. Vayamot ishi, my husband has died. I'm not 100% sure, but that sounds to me like what we would call a tautology, right? Or redundant. I'm a widow. My husband's died. If you're a widow, it's because your husband died. What does it mean, I'm a widow? Vayamot ishi, my husband died. Unless what she's describing is not the fact of her situation, but Ishal Manani, Vayamot Ishi. Right? What is she reflecting? Not the facts of the case, but
her suffering?
Right, the emotion of it, the personal side of it. Ishal Manani, Vayamot Ishi. This is a very personal story. Ishal Manani. Now, the word aval here is somewhat of an oddity, because we typically translate the word aval as but. Right? But you can't start a sentence with the word but. Vatomer, but. The first thing she says is but. Today we do it. We start sentences with the word so. We start sentences with the word. We do all kinds of strange things. But, right, conceptually, you can't start a sentence with the word but. Aval isha almanani. Aval ma. So for that, we need to understand that the word aval has a second meaning, and it fits into this context here very powerfully. And that is used often in the context of a recognition of a truth that is powerful, but perhaps less relevant until this moment. In other words, it's a recognition of a truth that's deep, that's profound. That's why it's translated here as truly. I'll give you two examples. We say in the Machzor, before, when we say vidui, on throughout the Yisrael Shemei Tshuva, and we say it to Slichos, we say Rosh Hashanah Kippur, we said, Aval anachnu v'avoteinu chatanu. Right? Ein anu zei panim k'she'orav l'malaf anecha Hashem alakeinu sadikim anachnu v'lo chatanu. We don't have the chutzpah to say before you, we are righteous and we have not sinned. Aval anachnu v'avoteinu chatanu. But we have sinned. So the two halves of that sentence are also not balanced. What does it mean, but? And the answer is that it doesn't mean but. There it means, but in truth, right? Aval, it's a recognition of a deep, profound truth. Aval, anachnu v'avoteinu chatanu. You see it also by the brothers, by Yosef and his brothers, when Yosef accuses them of being spies and he puts Shimon in jail and they have a conversation amongst themselves and they turn to each other and they say, Aval ashemim anachnu. But we are guilty. It's a but. In truth, we are guilty. Aval Hashemim Menachem. Now, Soloveitchik talks about this in Alachuva a little bit to recognize the power of this word. Aval Isha Almanani Veyamotishi. That's the whole story begins with this extraordinary recognition of the pain of her moment. Isha Almana Veyamotishi. She therefore has no husband. She has, right, she is the breadwinner, the head of the family, whatever the circumstances are, we'll see how it continues, how it plays out. But the fact that she is a widow is the key to understanding her plight.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
We don't know for sure that she really is a widow. I mean, this sounds like it may also be like, what's his name? Unknown's trick, you know, he was sick. Because he says it. I'm going to leave that
question for now.
Okay.
It's a valid question. It's a powerful question, and it's one of the key questions in this parak. But I don't have enough information to understand the question or the answer. But we'll come to it.
The JP Jerusalem Bible says, "I am indeed a widow, for my husband is dead."
Right, indeed, truly, or any those kinds of that translation will reflect that notion. Uleshivchatcha. Shnebanim, and your servant had two sons. Bayinatsu shnehem basadeh, and the two of them were having an argument in the field. Ve'ein matzil benehem, they're out in the field, there's nobody there, it's a quiet space. The sadeh is a place where there's not a lot of people around, and so there was no one there to separate them. They were getting into a fight, and there was nobody else around. And the fight got away from them. And in the end, one brother killed the other. The whole family has risen up against your maidser, your handmaid. And they've said, Vayomru. Now, before I read this, we spent some time in the last couple of weeks talking about the brother killing brother scenario. Avshalom kills Amnon. What is the punishment for such a circumstance? Right, the normal punishment for murder in the Torah is
it's a capital crime.
It's a capital crime. So the normal punishment for murder is death. Who executes the perpetrator, the murderer? Who is responsible for carrying out that sentence?
Not the court. Oh no,
the family of the
Goel Adam. Correct. Goel Adam is responsible for carrying out the justice and the vengeance for the victim. That gets more complicated in the case where the victim is the brother of the perpetrator. In that case, we said the family, the Goel Adam, is a relation to both the victim and the murderer. So in that case, you don't have right. One of the options was to exile, and that we talked a little bit about in Kain Behevel, and we talked about Avshalom going into exile. Now, it gets complicated when this family conflict, brother against brother. So v'nei kama kol ha'mishpacha, al shifchatecha. The whole family is risen up against your handmaid. Vayamru tni et makeachi v'numiteu b'nefesh achiv sheharag. And they've said to us, give us the brother so that we, as the Goel Adam, can kill, have him killed for the life that he took from his own brother. In other words, they want to implement exactly what the Torah says. Goel Adam comes along and says, we want to kill the guilty party, in this case, the brother who killed his brother. Brother A, brother B. The only problem is, if you remember what I told you, what we read in the Rambam, what is the sequence of who the Goel Adam is? Who is entitled to that position called the Goel Adam? The closest
the relative,
sons. Right? The
siblings. In case of an immediate family member, or if there's no sons, let's assume for a moment there's no sons, or there's no other sons.
Daughters?
Right. No. Whoever is, the Rambam's language is whoever is in line for the Yerusha. In other words, it's the closest relation. The closest relation in line to the inheritance of the family is the person of the deceased, is the person who is entitled to the position of Goel Adam. The problem is that gets complicated here. And that's exactly what complicates the story. Give us the brother and we will kill him. For this life who we took, and if they stop there, that would be okay. That would be, you know, terrible, but it would be understandable. But now they go one step further. V'nashmida gam et hayoresh, and we will destroy their heir, meaning this last brother, this woman only has two sons. And if she only has two sons, it means that the deceased's inheritance is now not only the brother who was killed, but also the father. Remember, the father is deceased. So you have the father's inheritance, which goes to the two sons. And now the two sons, one is dead and the other is the last remaining Yoresh, the last remaining heir to that inheritance. These Goel HaYadam, these relatives, they're like sharks in the water who smell blood. They take out the Yoresh. And what happens? Who gets the inheritance? If they kill the last remaining brother, who gets
the inheritance? Do they get to split it?
They do. Right? So the circumstances here are horrific because there's only one remaining son left who is the Yoresh, but he is the one who committed murder. All the relatives come, right? Kol HaMishpacha has arisen in crying out for the blood of this Yoresh. And in so doing, the chibuat gachaltia. Whoops, sorry about that. One of the problems with this website. You click the wrong button and you're. Chibuat gachaltia shenishara. And they will quench the last ember of the last coal of my family. Livilti sum ishi shemu sherit apnei adama. There'll be nothing left. My husband and my children, my husband's name will be erased from upon the earth. Levoti sum ishi, my husband, will no longer have a name or a remnant or a legacy upon this earth, because his legacy would have gone to his children. One child killed the other. That he's the Yoresh. All of his Yerusha would go to the Goel Adam. They want his blood. It's a mess. Now, that's the story. So why is she coming to David with a story? What is she expecting David to do? Why is she even involving David?
Does she know that Avshalom has been exiled? Does he want
to get Avshalom? Yes, she knows, but that's not the issue right now. We'll get to Avshalom. What is she asking David to do?
To reverse the decree, to change it.
Which decree?
That they would kill the other brother who is the heir.
He's committed murder.
They still want to maintain the family dynasty.
So what
or whatever.
Is she asking David to do?
Exile him? Rather than, or.
What is she asking?
Protect the second brother.
Say that again?
Protect the second brother.
Protect the second brother. She's going to let these vile sharks in the water take the blood of her only remaining child? She comes to David with a plea for pardon, for clemency, for protection. She comes to David and says, this is the last remnant of my family. So yes, he killed his brother. Yes, they were fighting in the field. Nobody was there to intervene. It got a little bit carried away. One pulled out a knife, and one thing led to another, and he killed him. And all of the rest of the family, they're out for blood. You, David, you're the king. You have the power of pardon. You have the power to forgive. You are the king. You can protect him.
In fact,
she starts with two words. Hoshia HaMelech, save me, help me, because you, King, have the power and the authority and the ability through your role as the Melech, as the Shofet, in the judicial sense, the head of the judiciary. You have the power to guarantee clemency, to forgive him, and to protect him. That's all she wants. Now there's not a word here about Avshalom yet. I understand. This isn't about Avshalom yet. This is about a story.
In fact, Yoav asked her to go to the king.
So again, how much of Yoav's role in this will come to? That's the question that we still have to ask. But for right now, what she's presented to the king is a story. And it's not the first time the king has been presented, or a king in Israel has been presented with a story to judge on, to rule on, which in the end will reflect upon his own circumstance and therefore will be held back to him with a mirror. And that's exactly the story of Natan and David by the Mashal of the Kivsat Arash. That was the story we read in chapter 12, right, where Natan comes to David and says, you are right. Here's the story. How would you rule in such a story, which is not uncommon, right? The king is a judge. How would you rule? When David rules harshly, Natan says to him two words.
It's you.
Ata ha'ish. But you first have to get the ruling. Then there's another case similar to that that we looked at the time in the end of Sefer Melachim by Ahav. Just show you a quick glance at it. Ahav, who was at some point or another was in the middle of a war with the king of Israel, with the king of Aram, and he gathers together and he has a meeting with the king of Aram. The king of Aram comes to him and he greets him and they make a peace pact. And the Navi is very upset that Ahav gave a royal welcome to the king of their arch enemy. And so he presents him with the following scenario, which is in Melachim Aleph Perak Chaf towards the end. And the Navi disguises himself as a soldier, battled, war-torn soldier. He disguises himself with covering with ashes on his face. And he's got all kinds of bruises because he had passed for a soldier. King is passing by, and this disguised soldier cries out to the king. And he says to him, Avdecha yatsa b'kerav ha-melchama, your servant had gone into the midst of the battle. Minei ish sar v'yaveh ish. And there was another soldier who came and he had a captured soldier, a POW, a soldier from the enemy. Vayomer, and he said to me, keep your eye on this guy. Hold on to him. He's my prisoner. I'm giving him into your charge. You are now in charge of watching him. But no, if he escapes, I will hold your life forfeit. Meantime, this is all what the Navi, who describes as a soldier, is telling the king. In the meantime, your servant was busy with this and with that, war, with whatever I was doing. And he disappeared. So now I'm asking the king, what is he asking the king for? He's asking the king to forgive him. He's asking the king for pardon. He's asking the king for mercy. Ahav was not known for mercy. Vayomer elav melech Yisrael, kein mishpatecha atacharatzta. So shall be your judgment. You yourself have expressed it. You just told me A guy said to me, if I let this guy go, my life will be forfeit. You've decreed your own judgment. So Ahav says to him, you are a dead man. At which point the Navi removes his disguise and he says to him, the Navi to Ahav, Koma Hashem, Yan, Shilachta et ish chermi miyad vaitan nafsho memcha tachat amo, because you let go the enemy who was in your grasp. You could have ended this before it started. You let him go. You had him. You made a peace treaty with him. You had lunch with him instead of incarcerating him and killing him. Therefore, your life for his life. So the context there is very similar to David in the case of Bathsheba, namely the Navi comes, presents the king with the story, and after the king rules on that story, passes judgment, the Navi holds up a mirror and says, "Atah ish, this is you." More or less, that's exactly what the Shat Koit is doing with David. She's telling him a story, which it doesn't take much for us to figure out where Avshalom is in the story. Right? If David pardons the brother for having killed his brother, you can already see where that's going to lead to the question of, well, then how come you didn't pardon one brother for killing the other brother? If you had compassion over this brother, why didn't you have compassion over Avshalom? Right? So you can already see where a little bit of this is going. But in the meantime, this is the story she presents. Okay. Now, before we get into the ruling that David issues, which starts in Pasuk Chet, there's a couple of things I want to point out about this story. So remember, it starts in what we're going to call the Mashal, right? The parable, the story, assuming we don't know yet, in answer to the question that was asked earlier, we don't know if it's a true story, which is being used for a certain result, or if the entire story is a fabrication. We don't know that yet. But in the meantime, there's a couple of things that we need to recognize. First of all, we started with the fact that she was not just a woman in the city, but the Navi describes her as Isha Chachama. She's a wise woman. Why is she? What is the Chachma here in her presentation? So, if we think back to the goal that she's trying to evoke, which is the comparison between the circumstances of her son and the circumstances of David's son, right? If you're trying to evoke in his mind subconsciously an association between these two stories, she does a couple of things here which are very subtle. And I'm not sure that Yoav would have thought about them, meaning Yoav strikes me as a very blunt instrument, which is true about most generals in the army, I would say, right? Certainly in Tanakh, he's a blunt instrument. Subtlety is not his forte. She, on the other hand, is an Isha Chachama. And so everything about the story, whether fabricated or not, is a subtlety in trying to evoke from David a sense of the nuance and the language and the emotion of the moment. So, for example, it starts with a description of her circumstance. Remember, the whole point is about the two sons. But before she gets into the two sons, what does she describe? She says, Aval Isha Almanani Vayamot Ishi. Suddenly, the story starts with her own plight, her own challenges. And so by the very beginning, Oshia HaMelech, Aval Isha Almanani Vayamot Ishi, nothing to do with one brother against another. And suddenly David is pulled into the compassion, the emotion of the story. Then she describes the two sons. Now she doesn't say one son who committed a terrible act and the other son decided to take an act of vengeance and kill the first son, right? That's not the story. What is the story? And the two of them were fighting in the field. What were they fighting about? What do you say?
Because it's irrelevant.
It doesn't say, because He probably was irrelevant. In other words, they were having an argument. And they were in the field where there weren't a lot of other people. The Ein Matzu Benehem. And the circumstances developed. One went to the other. The fight began to ensue. They began to hit each other and smite each other, smelt each other. Before you knew it, they killed him. Was it premeditated? Was it intentional? Was it calculated? Was it vengeful? No. It was an argument that got away from them. You know who it sounds like? Who else had an argument in the field and the argument sort of got away from them and one killed the other? That story sound familiar?
Cain and Abel?
Yeah, there's a little bit of Cain and Hevel in the story. Because you go back to the story of Cain and Hevel, we're going to look at for a second. Translate this sentence for me. Cain said to his brother Hevel, it was when they were in the field, Cain was up against his brother and killed him. What is Vayomer Cain al Hevel Achiv? What did Cain say to Hevel? Cain said to Hevel, his brother, right in there, that blue box. What did Cain say to Hevel? So if I opened up the Mefarshim, you would see a list of Mefarshim 12 feet long, each one with a different opinion as to what exactly Cain said to Hevel. There's a Medrash that talks about the three different options, and there's all kinds of Mefarshim get involved in this conversation. What did Cain say to Hevel? The bottom line of it is we have no idea because it's irrelevant. What it probably means is, they were having a conversation. Cain and Hevel out in the field having a conversation. What about? I can imagine. You brought your korban, I brought my korban, God took yours, God didn't take mine. Why do you think you're better than me? I'm not better than you. What are you talking about? Why are you the favorite child? I'm not the favorite child. Before you know it, vahi biyotam basadeh. They're out in the field. Vayakum kain, I'll have a chiviyageyo. Is that not exactly what the Shatkui just said? They're out in the field, and there's nobody to intervene. I have only two children. Cain and Hevel were the only two children. My one son killed the other. Cain killed Hevel. The circumstances are exactly the same. And so in her language, she evokes from the story not only the compassion of the circumstances, and the lack of guilt and the argument to exonerate the brother who killed his, right, who's surviving, but also the association with Cain and Hevel. And that's very targeted. We'll see why that's so in a second. That's one or two pieces of her chokhmah. The other piece of her chokhmah was suddenly she threw into the question of who this Goel Adam is. Who is the Goel Adam? Who is the avenger of blood here? What's going on here? What has she done here? She didn't say one killed the other. And now the Goel Adam wants justice, wants some sort of justice for the deceased brother Nebuch. This isn't about justice. This is about corruption. This is about money. This is about lust. This is about Benashmina Gamat Yeresh. All they want is the inheritance. And they're coming after my son, not because he did something wrong. They're coming after my son because they smell blood, because they smell the inheritance. And then the third element of it, which is, if they kill the last remaining child of this family, not only do I have one victim, not only do I then have a second victim, I have a third victim. Who's the third victim? my husband.
Her husband.
Right? With those whole stories started with Aishal Manani Vayamat Ishi, my husband. Livotil Sum Ishi Shem Shirita Pnei Adama. Who will be left with my husband? What will be left of my husband's legacy? By the way, the argument of this sense that the legacy will be destroyed and eradicated from Me'al Pnei Ha'adama was used by somebody else. Anybody know who? Anybody want to try to take a guess? Vayomer Hashem al Kain, Ehevel Achicha, God says to Kain, where's your brother? And he says, I don't know. Shomachi Enochi. So God says to him, what are you talking about? The blood is crying out from the ground. And God punishes him. Avurata min adama. Na benati ba'aretz. We call that exile. I'm exiling you from the earth. Vayomer Kain al Hashem gadol avani minso. My punishment is too great to bear. And Girashti Ayom Ayal Pnei Adama, if you expel me, banish me from upon the earth, Me'al Pnei Adama, anybody who finds me, I'll be a wanderer. Anybody who finds me will kill me. So for some reason, God hears Cain's plea for mercy. And what does God say? I'll protect you. Kol hareg Cain shivatayim yukam. Anybody who kills Cain will have to answer to me. So I will protect you. And the argument of you're banishing me, me'al pnei adama, is too hard a punishment to bear. What does the Ishat Gurit say? If you let the family kill the final surviving child, then my husband's remnant legacy will be destroyed, me'al pnei adama. And therefore, what is she asking? She's evoking all of the pieces of the story of Cain and Abel. What is he asking David to do? She's asking David to do exactly what the Kodesh Baruch Hu did for Cain. There's no greater murder in the history of Jewish of Tanakh than Cain. And yet God is willing to protect him. God is willing to protect Cain. Maybe you, David, should protect my only surviving son.
Rabbi,
yeah.
We're talking about people being out in the field and ending up in an argument. With Avshalom, he had 2 years that he seemed to have been planning this.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't a spontaneous thing, and it's a different kind of story. It's a first degree or.
So at the end of the shiur today, which is not the end of the parak, which we won't get to the end of the parak, but at the end of the shiur today, I will explore.
Okay, sorry.
Where this mashal? No. You're the question is exactly right. Where this mashal falls short, the difference between this story and David's story is night and day. There's if I wanted to, I could break this down and draw every from every angle how this story has nothing or resembles nothing whatsoever like the story of Avshalom. How it therefore manages to achieve its goal is a mystery. And we're going to resolve it, but it's going to take us some time. But that's the key question. Avshalom is premeditated.
He's already in exile and nobody's trying to kill him.
Yeah, there's more to it. There's a few pieces I want to get to in a few minutes. So let's just hold it. We'll come back to it. There's a I was going to do it now, but there's a few extra pieces we need to explore. Okay, so let's see how David reacts. Vayomer ha-melech al ha-isha, lechi le-betech, v'ani etzave aleich. What does David just say? Yes, no, I agree, don't agree. What does David say? Lechi levetech, v'ani etzave aleich. Go home, and I will issue commands concerning you. That's what he says. So, somebody want to tell me what that means? Yes, nothing. No, he agrees. He doesn't agree.
It means nothing.
It means exactly what it says, nothing. Go home, call me in the morning. What's the lawyers on this conversation will forgive me for the next sentence, but the most important tool of any legal consultation is take it under advisement. Right? Take it under advisement. I'll take it under advisement. Oh, I hear you. I hear you. So the Ishatkuit is not satisfied. Alai Adoni Melech Avon V'al Beiti V'al Beit Avi V'Melech V'Kiso Naki. What has she said? This is one of the most difficult psukim in this story because it's not clear what she's saying here. The iniquity is upon me, my king, and my household, and the king in his throne will be guiltless. If what? So here's a major machloket in the Mefarshim. Rashi says that she's really pointing to the king. She's just saying it in a kind of a way of deflecting the language, like Paro when he says about Israel, in this week's parasha, the beginning, first parak, that if the Bnei Israel gets too strong, the alamin aretz to leave the land. And Rashi says what he really meant to say was that they'll force us to leave the land. But he didn't want to say that, so he kind of euphemistically switched it. So what she really means to say is that this iniquity, if my son is killed, is on you. But she doesn't want to say that. So she says, it's on me. Which, that's Rashi's interpretation. Well, Bag takes a somewhat different tack. He says that she's driving a Musser point home to David and saying, okay, you don't want to save him. That's fine. I will bear the iniquity. If something happens to my son, I won't blame the king. If something happens to my son, I won't blame the king. Is there a bug? To show you the... it's hard for me to get to the... Actually, I'll do it here. Is there a bug? It says... Avon mitzichat bena, the iniquity of the murder of her son, im yirtzuchu b'nei mishpacha, if the family does get to him and take and kills him, I will bear that iniquity. B'nei amad derech musar, and she's giving the king a little musar, like a little kick in the, you know, harot shem melech asher kazeh lo yikach etzah shelo yatzilo, such a king, you won't even take the steps to save him. I'll suffer that iniquity. Okay. So you, king, are absolved. But understand what that means for to be such a king. It's another possibility that Alai is a kind of a reference to what Rivka says to Yaakov when she's trying to convince him to take the bracha. She says, Alai kilalatcha bani. If anything happens to you, it'll be on my shoulders. And she says to the king, if you do something here, Alai hamelech kisanaki, it'll be my intervention. You are absolved. But in all cases, she makes an argument, whatever that argument is, and the king responds. Oh no, says the king to her, I won't let anything happen to your son. If anybody comes to you and tries to harm your son, you bring him to me. Anybody comes to you about your son, you bring them to me. And then nobody will touch them. Okay, that's already a response. I take upon myself to guarantee that I will talk to the perpetrators of this terrible thing. And if they come to threaten your son, you bring them to me and we'll have a good talking to. What's the only problem? What's the problem?
Well, it seems like, it does seem like if someone comes and says anything to her is not really the problem, but
Yeah, I don't think they're having a conversation about, okay, where's your son? We're going to take him out. You know, they're not coming to him or her. And even if they were, what is she going to bring these family members who are trying to kill her son? She's going to bring them to David? Hamedaber elayech vahaveto elay, you bring him to me. Me? I'm supposed to bring these people to you, David? So she responds and she says, "Vatoma yiskorna hamelech at Hashem elokecha meharbat goel adam." Do you know how many avengers of blood there are? L'shachet, to destroy. V'lo yashmidu et bni, they should not destroy my son. Let the king remember God. These avengers are not coming to, these are Goel Adam. They're not sitting there and having conversations in coffee shops. They're coming in to kill. So finally, by the time this is all finished, David hears it. David recognizes the plight by Yomer, and he says what he should have said. Chai Hashem. This is a language of a shavua. This is an oath. I take it as an oath, as God lives, an oath on God's name. Not one hair of your son shall fall to the earth. Meaning, how is he going to live up to that oath? How do you live up to that oath?
You bring him in and protect him.
Yeah. Now, David has to bring all the resources of his kingdom to protect this son. Now, it's not about, okay, if the Goel Adam comes knocking at your door, you say, you know what, the king wants to speak to you and see where that goes. This is about not only granting the pardon, but in fact, bringing the resources of the kingdom to protect this child. Because of the emotional circumstances and the moral circumstances of this case, it is the moral thing to do to protect the legacy of this family. Fine? Now, at that point in time, maybe we could argue that her job is done and she's gotten the pardon, the clemency that she's asked for. And let David draw the conclusions, which are that, okay, so he is the son who's committed murder against his brother. And if he's willing to forgive one, he should be willing to forgive the other. David's not so quick to draw the association. And it's not surprising because the circumstances have nothing in common. Right? What circumstances are in common? She's, compare for a moment, the two parents. In her case, she is a widow with one child. If that child is convicted, then she's literally lost her entire family. Does that match David's case? Is that anything similar to David's circumstances? First of all, he's not a widow or a widower. Second of all, he's got many wives and many children. There's not even a beginning of a comparison. Okay, next piece of the story. One brother killed another brother. How?
Heat of the moment argument.
Heat of the moment argument. They're out in the field, they're having a conversation, they're having an argument, they're fighting about something, and you know what? One drew a knife and the other drew a knife, and before you knew it, it got out of hand. Is that what happened to Avshalom? Two brothers out in the field having an argument? This is premeditated, orchestrated, calculated murder, fratricide, treason, killed the kings, the heir to the throne, killed his. And you could argue Amnon deserved it. Amnon, look what Amnon did. Okay, but it's 2 years he planned this out. And the most significant difference of it, what happens to the circumstances of the broader circumstance, if David grants clemency to this woman's child, What consequences are there to that act? If David pardons this child of this widow,
he'll still have a family legacy.
Is there any danger to that act of pardon?
Well, people will think that it's okay to kill people.
No, the people would think people keep it. The circumstances here are so circumstantial, and he's after all, they were having a fight, and it was an accident, and they can't even prove that it was intentional. It wasn't intentional, and right, the moral clarity around this act of pardon is clear. Is there any particular political fallout from such an act? I don't think so. At the end of the day, you're dealing with an individual family in crisis, and David acts morally to protect the integrity of the family and the family legacy. Is there any particular political danger in bringing back Avshalom?
Well, he will be the king.
Well, we don't know that yet, because we don't know who the heir to the throne will be. But what would happen if you bring back Avshalom, who's committed treason, premeditated murder?
He either wasn't alive or was a kid.
Right. You understand that David is Avshalom is an inch away from an all-out, full-scale rebellion against David's reign. In exile, he can't do anything. In Yerushalayim, he's right there in your backyard. Bringing back Avshalom, perceived as treason, as forgiving somebody who's committed treason, politically, is suicide. So the circumstances of these two stories could not be further apart. And yet, this is the story that she starts with which to evoke from David his agreement to pardon Avshalom. He hasn't gotten there yet. All right. That was going to be at the end of the year. We did it. Now let's move to the next piece. If you happen to be following in the Tanakh, you can kind of see this, the paragraph breaks, but in this website, it's harder to see, but we'll, it's not going to help us. Okay. Batomer Aisha. Now that David has agreed to pardon her son. And again, keep in mind the question, is the son real, is the story real? Right? That's always been the question in the back of our minds since we started the parak. Batomer Aisha, tidaberna shivchatcha al Adonai HaMelech Davar. Would it be okay if I had a few words to the king? Permission to speak plainly, right? Can I speak my heart? Vayomer, daberi. So he says, speak. Vatomer Aisha. Balam chashavta kazot alam elokim. Umendaber hamelech hadavar hazeh ke'ashem livilti ashiv hamelech et nidcho. If that sentence makes sense, great. I'm not quite sure how to translate it. The grammar here is very hard to understand because it's not syntactically whole. But she says more or less, why would you consider such a thing about the people of God? In speaking this word, the king is one who is guilty. The king is as if the king is guilty. Because the king refuses to return the one who is banished. Now she's put it on the table, right? Who's she speaking about? Right? Who's she talking about now? Avshalom.
Avshalom.
For we must all die and are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up, and God does not favor any soul or forgive any soul. I have no idea what she's saying. But whatever it is, it's certainly she's piling on the emotion. We will all die like water spilled on the ground. And God doesn't forgive. You don't forgive. Let him devise means that he that is banished is not an outcast. Don't banish him twice. Again, we have to come back to these psukim and understand them. But she's getting emotional and she's getting intense. Sorry. So first she says, why do you think such a thing of the people of God? You as one who is guilty, you of one who have sent your son into banishment. Then she says, people all die. Like water spilled on the ground and nobody cares. Well, you let him out as an outcast and not bring him home. And now I have come to speak to the king. This is what I've come to speak to the king about, the davar hazeh. Because the people made me afraid. The people made me afraid. I looked at the people and I said, you know what? I have to speak to the king. Maybe the king will do something. The king will hear, the king will devise some means to deliver his maidservant from the hands of the one who would destroy me, the Edbini and my son, together, Yachad, and destroy us from the inheritance of God. So your maidservant said, let the word of the king be as a source of comfort. Because you are like a malach, and like an angel of God. You listen, you discern between good and evil, and may God bless you. It's a fascinating speech because she's so articulate and so clear in her description of the plight in part one, what we call the mashal. But the moment she jumps into, my dear king, can I speak plainly? Her words are almost unintelligible. The sentence structure falls apart. The grammar, the syntax here falls apart. Right? There's phrases here that don't make any sense. They're just pulled together. You can read the translation, it makes no more sense than the Hebrew. One thing is clear. Who is she talking about here? That I think is self-evident. Who is she talking about?
Avshalom. Well, there's one banished one right now. Correct.
There's only one banished one. Hatnitcho. And the king is guilty of banishing him. The king is guilty in not returning the one who's been banished. That's the piece of the story that she's driving at. Why should we all die while he's in banishment? The banished might be an outcast. We're going to have to come back and take this all apart. But at the end of her, so there's two issues here. One is why is she so intelligible in the first half of her speech and so unintelligible in the second half of her speech? So I think the answer to that is very simple. It's very powerful. Right? Up until now, she's been describing a case, a story, a mishpat, maybe even a fiction. Although she seems to stay in the fiction role. If you look at Pasuk Tetzayin carefully, she talks about saving her son and herself from being banished or destroyed from the inheritance, right? So she's staying in that parable role a little bit. But there she was talking about the case objectively. Here she's talking about the king, accusing the king of banishing his son and of not having compassion for his son and not being able to place the same kind of compassion that he had over her plight and over her son's plight over Avshalom's plight. She could have said this in two words. Namely?
Save Avshalom.
What two words should she have said in this whole paragraph? When the king said to her, can I speak plainly? She said, and the king said, speak. She should have said two words. Same two words Natan said to David.
Oh, Ataish.
Ataish. And that would have been the end of the story. She starts with this emotional. So part of it is a recognition that sometimes when emotions play a role in the conversation, we get less articulate. We're very articulate. We can be very methodical, articulate, and careful in our words when we are slow and not emotional. But the moment we start to get intense and emotional in our conversation, we tend to speed up and we tend to have sentence structures that jump from one theme to another, one idea to another. And so in our own speech, we sometimes, when emotions get involved, get less clear and articulate and structured in how we communicate. In Tanakh, the way that's conveyed is by leaving the original confusion in her words intact and not sorting it out for us. So I think that that's reflected here. You have that that emotional turmoil in her as she's coming to the king and giving him Musar over the banishment of Avshalom, and suddenly her whole structure breaks down. But something else happens.
Is that because she's afraid that he's going to kill her? Because she's not afraid.
I don't think she's afraid. I think that she's just emotional.
Yeah, but it's not even her story, so we think.
Correct, but
how do you get emotional over something that's not?
How do you get emotional? What's at stake here? What's at stake here is the future of the Jewish people. What's at stake is the future of the Malchus. What's at stake is the integrity of the civil society. All of civil society is broken down. We're all going to die like water spilled on the ground. This is chaos. This is anarchy. Kingdom can't continue like this.
But she's kind of promoting anarchy by saying to save him.
No. We'll see what she's promoting. She's promoting a very orderly... she's promoting a very specific issue, which is Avshalom is sitting out there in exile. And where's the king? Where's the king in all of this? So his response, Vayana Melech, Vayomer Elaisha. So now, in this turmoil, in her words, the king takes us one step further. And he says to her, Al natechachadim imeni davar. I want the truth and nothing but the truth. Don't hide anything from me. I'm going to ask you a very pointed question. I don't want you to dodge around it. Speak. Did Yoav put you up to this? David's brilliance. The moment she began to lose the coherency of her conversation because she's trying to get to a point that she hasn't been able to articulate, suddenly he says, you know what, this isn't your story. Somebody put you up to this. Who put you up to it? I know who did it. Yoav. Batana Ishavatomer, hey, Nafshacha, the Neamelach, Ish, meaning Yesh, Leheminu, last meal, Nikolash, the Bear, the Neamelach, Yabdacha, Yoav, Tsivani, Bussam, Befishiv, Chatra, Kolatrimela. There is no hiding this from you, my king. Yoav put me up to this. Yoav commanded me. Yoav gave me the story. Yoav told me. For what purpose? The entire purpose here was for him to change your mind. And you are wiser. You are like an angel of God. You know everything that's in the land. And that's it. She goes home. She said her piece. She got emotional at one point when the request, the key part of the request came in. She couldn't get the words out. She couldn't get the articulated idea out. David saw that the whole thing was a ruse, turns to her and says, Yoav put you up to this. Now, if you're David, I want you to read the next sentence. If you're David, what's your next words to Yoav?
he would grant Avshalom to come home.
Yeah, that's what you would say to Avshalom? Yeah, to Yoav?
You'd be mad at him. Okay. No, how dare you?
What are you playing me for?
You're fired, yeah.
What are you playing me for? You go and hire some woman from Tekoa to come to convince me to do something. You don't have the guts and the chutzpah to come face me? To ask me to do something which is treasonous, which is politically devastating. That I should bring Avshalom back and grant him clemency and grant him a pardon and let the entire world know that murder and fratricide and brother killing brother and treason is acceptable? I was David. That's what I would say to you all. But I'm not David. Yomer HaMelech HaYoav. Hinei na'asiti et hadavar hazeh. Okay, Yoav, I agree. Velech hashev et hanar et Avshalom. Go bring Avshalom home. And Yoav's response, Vayipol Yoav apanav arza vayishtachu. What's his response? His response is, oh, great king, how wonderful it is that you have compassion for your son Avshalom. How great it is that you consider Avshalom worthy of your kingdom. How wonderful it is that you will bring Avshalom home. Not a word of it. He blesses the king and he says to him, today I know that I have found favor in your eyes, because you, the king, have done what I have requested. So who's the hero of the story?
Yoav thinks he is.
Yoav thinks he is. It's really quite extraordinary. Ve'yakam Yoav ba'yelach Geshua ve'yaveh et Avshalom Yerushalayim. Yoav comes, goes all the way to Geshur, brings Avshalom back to Yerushalayim. We're going to read one more sentence. And they all live happily ever after. Right? Avshalom comes home. David embraces him. David and Avshalom have a big reunion. And Yoav is there to celebrate. And everybody's dancing. And it's a big kumbaya. Vayakom Yoav v'yelach Geshua v'yaveh Avshalom Yerushalayim. Vayomer HaMelech Yisovel Beito Ufanai Lo Yireh. Let him go home to his house. Me he will not see. House arrest. To the palace, he will not step foot. To his home, let him go. To the palace, he will not step foot. And David refuses to see him. You know for how long? I'm going to skip the next couple of psukim because the shir is over at this point. But we'll come back to these psukim next week. But Vishlach Avshalom at Yoav, Vishlach Oto al HaMelech. He said, Avshalom sent to Yoav to ask him to come to see him. I skipped a sentence. Oh, no, Pasuk Chavchet. Vayeshev Avshalom b'Yerushalayim shnataim yamim. Pnei HaMelech l'ra. For 2 years, Avshalom sat in exile in Yerushalayim. He sat in exile for 3 years in Geshur, comes back to Yerushalayim. David refuses to see him. He cannot step foot in the palace. For 2 years, he sits in exile in Yerushalayim. Exile from the palace, exile from David. And you have to ask yourself the obvious question, which is, why bring him back? If you're going to keep him in exile, why bring him back if you're not going to see him? Why bring him back if you're not going to pardon him? What's David's game? What's Yoav's game? What is the political machinations going on between everybody involved in the story? Yoav, Avshalom, and David.
So, Rabbi, does David even have a game? Or is he just kind of flying by the seat of his pants?
No, I don't believe David is flying by the seat of his pants. I think David reads them all. Because if he wouldn't be David if he wasn't able to read Yoav and to read Avshalom and to read the people and to understand. He's got his own challenges, but he's far more astute than that. We'll see how that plays out. But at this point, that's the big mystery. What was Yoav trying to accomplish? What is Avshalom's agenda here? And what is David's agenda here? And how does the Ishar Tikrit play into all of this? That's our task for the remaining couple of shiurim in this chapter. We will continue Bezrat Hashem next week.
Rabbi, thank you very much for the shiur. As usual, it was amazing. Does David know that ostensibly, and is it ostensibly, that Avshalom killed Amnon because of avenging his sister, the rape of his sister?
Yeah, he was told explicitly. He was told explicitly at the end of the previous parak. Let's go back one parak. When he's when the story is being told to him, Yan Yonatav ben Shima Achi David veYomer Al Yomar Adoni Atan Kol Enarim Bnei Malachemitu. Yonatav ben Shima says to David, don't think that Avshalom has killed everybody, the whole royal family. Ki Amnon levadome al pi Avshalom hayta suma miyom anato Tamar achato. He's been planning this for 2 years from the day that Amnon raped his sister. So yeah, he knows that very clearly.
I have another question. You told us in our studies, there was another situation where they were talking quickly and so on. I remember you telling us that, but I can't remember what the situation was.
We've had it a few times. We've had it by when Shaul first comes to the city where Shmuel is waiting for him, and he sees all the women standing outside gawking at him. And you have a conversation there between Shaul and the women, and it's a completely incoherent conversation. Each one is talking over the other. So that's another example. We had it by Yonatan and David earlier in Shmuel Aleph. It appears in a number of places where the coherency of the text breaks down because there's a kind of an emotional tension that's taking place. It's a tool that's worth.
I remember you saying that. I just couldn't remember where it happened. Thank you.
I got a question.
Yeah.
When we first meet Yonadav, was he not described as a chacham also?
Yes. Yes.
Is there a connection there?
Probably, in the sense that the ability for them to kind of discern and read the map, read the circumstances, right? She's able to discern and read the circumstances of David's plight and use that language context, but that is correct. Yonadav is also described as Ish Chacham Me'od. The only thing she doesn't get is the Me'od.
Yeah.
Okay.
She got emotional.
Yeah. All right. We will stop here. Thank you all for joining us, and we will see you, Bezrat Hashem, next week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Pleasure.